Chapter 8. Planet of the Apes. What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form, in moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. But he wouldn't want to watch him eat close up. William Shakespeare was another key figure in the transition from medieval mysticism to post-Renaissance rationalism. We were going to mention him, but we had to wait for him to turn up in Round World. Shakespeare's plays are a cornerstone of our present Western civilization. On his first visit to England in 1930, Mahatma Gandhi was asked, "What do you think of modern civilization?" He is said to have replied, "That would be a good idea." Shakespeare's plays led us from a confrontation between aristocratic barbarism and tradition-bound tribalism into real civilization as we know it. And yet, he seems to be a contradiction, uplifting sentiments in a barbarous age. That's because he was standing at a pivotal point in history. The elves aren't the only Discworld inhabitants that have interfered with Roundworld. The wizards have tried some uplift of their own, in the sense of David Brin and using the techniques of Arthur C. Clarke. Near the end of The Science of Discworld, the apes of Roundworld are sitting in their cave watching a manifestation from another dimension, an enigmatic black rectangular slab. The Dean of Unseen University taps on it with his pointer to attract attention and chalks the letters R-O-C-K. Rock. Can anyone tell me what you'd do with it? But all the apes are interested in is S-E-X. The next time the wizards look at Roundworld, the space elevator is collapsing. The planet's inhabitants are heading out into the universe on vast ships made from the cores of comets. Something very dramatic has happened between the apes and the space elevator. What was it? The wizards have no idea. They doubt very much it could have had much to do with those apes, who were very much the wrong stuff. In the first volume of The Science of Discworld, we explored no further. We left a gap. It was a tiny part of the historical record on the geological timescales that governed everything up to the ape, but rather a big gap in terms of changes to the planet. But now, even the wizards are aware that the apes, unpromising material as they may have been, did in fact evolve into the creatures that built the space elevator and fled from a very dangerous planet in search of, as Rincewind would put it, a place where you are not hit on the head with rocks on a regular basis. And, apparently, a key step in their evolution was elvish interference. How did it actually happen on Roundworld? Here, the whole process took a mere 5 million years. 100,000 grandfathers ago, we and the chimpanzees shared a distant ancestor. Grandfathers, a time measurement we developed in The Science of Discworld as a human way of measuring large amounts of time. It's 50 years, a typical age gap between grandparent and grandchild. Most of the really interesting bits of human development have taken place in the last 150 grandfathers. Remember, objects in the rearview mirror are closer than they appear. The chimpanzee-like ancestor of man was also the man-like ancestor of the chimpanzee. To us, it would have looked astonishingly like a chimpanzee, but to a chimpanzee, it would have looked astonishingly like a human. DNA analysis shows, beyond any shadow of reasonable doubt, that our closest living relatives are chimpanzees. The ordinary, robust chimpanzee pan troglodytes and the more slender, gracile bonobo pan paniscus, often politically incorrectly called the pygmy chimpanzee. Our genomes have 98% in common with both, leading Jared Diamond to refer to humans as the third chimpanzee in a book of the same title. The same DNA evidence indicates that we and today's chimpanzees parted company, species-wise, those 5 million years, 100,000 grandfathers ago. That figure is debatable, but it can't be very far wrong. The gorillas split off a little earlier. The earliest fossils of our hominid ancestors are found in Africa, but there are numerous later fossilized hominids from other parts of the world, such as China and Java. The oldest known are two species of Australopithecus, each about 4 to 4.5 million years old. The Australopithecines had a good run. They hung around until about 1 to 1.5 million years ago, at which point they gave way to genus Homo. Homo ruralfensis, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, Homo ergaster, Homo heidelbergensis, Homo neanderthalensis, and finally us, Homo sapiens. And somehow another Australopithecine inserted itself into the middle of those Homos. In fact, the more hominid fossils we find, the more complicated our conjectured ancestry becomes, and it now looks as if many different hominid species coexisted on the plains of Africa for most of the past 5 million years. Today's chimpanzees are quite bright, probably a lot brighter than the apes that the dean tried to teach spelling to. Some remarkable experiments have shown that chimps can understand a simple version of language presented to them as symbolic shapes. They can even form simple concepts and make abstract associations, all within a linguistic frame. They can't build a space elevator, and they never will, unless they evolve considerably and avoid being killed for bushmeat. We can't build one either, but it might take no more than a couple of hundred years before the things are sprouting all along the equator. All you need is a material with enough tensile strength, perhaps some composite involving carbon nanotubes. Then you dangle cables from geostationary satellites, hang elevator compartments from them, equip them with suitable space elevator music, after which leaving the planet becomes entirely straightforward. The energy cost, hence the marginal financial cost, is near enough zero, because for everything that needs to go up, something else needs to come down. It could be moon rock, or platinum mined in the asteroid belt, or the astronaut that the person going up is due to replace on duty. The capital cost of such a project is enormous, though, which is why we're not in any great hurry right now. The big scientific problem in this connection is, how can evolution get so quickly from an ape that can't compete mentally with a chimpanzee to a godlike being that can write poetry as good as Shakespeare's, and has advanced so rapidly from that point that it will surely soon erect, drop, a space elevator? 100,000 grandfathers hardly seems long enough, given that it took about 50 million grandfathers to get from a bacterium to the first chimpanzee. Most of them being grandfather bacteria, you appreciate. That's the trouble with metaphors. Something that dramatic needed a new trick. That trick was the invention of culture. Culture allowed any individual ape to make use of the ideas and discoveries of thousands of other apes. It let the ape collective acquire knowledge cumulatively, so that it didn't all get lost when its owner died. In Figments of Reality, we coined the term extelligence for this suite of tricks. Now, the word is beginning to become common currency. Extelligence is like our own personal intelligence, but it lives outside us. Intelligence has limits. Extelligence is infinitely expandable. Extelligence lets us pull ourselves upwards as a group by our own mental bootstraps. The contradiction between Shakespeare's noble sentiments and the head-on spikes culture in which he lived is a consequence of his position as a very intelligent intelligence in a not very extelligent extelligence. Many individuals possessed the nobility to qualify for Shakespeare's praise, but their, as yet, rudimentary extelligence had not yet transmitted that nobility into the general culture. The culture was, or claimed to be, noble in principle, kings taking their authority from God himself. But it was a barbarian style of nobility, and it was welded to a barbarian cruelty, the king's means of self-preservation. There may be many ways to make intelligent creatures, and many more ways to knit them together into an extelligent culture. The crap civilization in the science of Discworld was doing fine, until its great leap sideways was clobbered by an inbound comet. We made that one up, but who knows what might have happened 100 million years ago. All we know for sure, or for a given value of sure, since even now a lot of our knowledge is guesswork, is that some things, like apes, turned into us. It takes a special kind of arrogance and blindness to extrapolate that story to the rest of the universe without wondering about alternatives. An important ingredient in our story was brains. Weight for weight, humans have far bigger brains than any other animal on the planet. The average human brain has a volume of about 1,350 cubic centimetres, which is roughly three times as great as the brain of apes with the same size body as ours. Whale brains are bigger than ours, but whales are even bigger, so the amount of whale per brain cell is greater than the amount of human per brain cell. When it comes to brains, quantity is less important than quality, of course. But a brain capable of really complicated things like carbon nanotube engineering and fixing dishwashers has to be fairly large, because the abilities of small brains are limited, by lack of room, to do anything interesting. We'll see shortly that brains alone are not enough. Nonetheless, without brains or adequate substitutes, you don't get very far. There are two main theories of human origins. One is rather dull and probably correct. The other is exciting and most likely wrong. Nevertheless, the second one has quite a lot going for it and is a better story. So let's take a look at them both. The dull conventional theory is that we evolved on the savannas. Roving groups of early apes trailed through the long grass, picking up whatever food, seeds, lizards, insects they could find, much like today's baboons, though they're monkeys, not apes. And as they did so, lions and leopards prowled through the long grass, looking for monkeys. Those monkeys or apes that were better at spotting the telltale flicker of a big cat's tail and finding a tree rather quickly survived to have babies. Those that performed poorly at such tasks did not. The babies inherited those survival skills and passed them on to their babies. What these tasks need is computational power. Spotting a tail and finding a tree are pattern recognition problems. Your brain needs to pick out the tail shape from a background of similarly buff-coloured rocks and mud. It has to choose a tree that is tall enough and climbable enough without being too climbable, and it has to be able to do it fast. A capacious brain with a big memory of past occasions when something hairy poked out from behind a rock and of locations for climbable trees can pick up the visual traces of a lion much more effectively than a small brain can. A brain whose nerve cells transmit signals to each other more quickly can analyze incoming sensory data and conclude lion a lot faster than a slower brain can. So there was evolutionary pressure on the early apes and monkeys to develop bigger and faster brains. There was also evolutionary pressure on the lions to conceal themselves more effectively, so that those bigger and faster ape and monkey brains still didn't notice anything suspicious. So a predator-prey arms race developed, a positive feedback loop that made both lions and apes far more effective in their ecological roles. That is the conventional story of human evolution. But there is another story, less orthodox, with two main sources. Human beings are very weird apes, indeed very weird animals altogether. They have extremely short fur, mostly just a downy covering. They walk upright on two legs. They have a layer of fat all the year round. They mate face to face, often. They have exceptionally good breath control, good enough to be able to speak. They weep and they sweat. They adore water and can swim long distances. A newborn baby dropped in a pool can keep itself afloat. The ability to swim is instinctive. All these peculiarities led Elaine Morgan to write The Aquatic Ape in 1982. There she suggested a radical theory that humans evolved not on the savannas surrounded by fierce predators, but on the beach. That explains the swimming, the upright stance. It's easier to evolve a two-legged gait if you are buoyed up by seawater, and the lack of hair, which causes problems when you swim, providing an evolutionary reason for it to disappear. In fact, it can be argued that it explains all the peculiarities of humans that we've just listed. The original scientific underpinnings of this theory were developed by Alistair Hardy. In their 1991 The Driving Force, Michael Crawford and David Marsh took the story one stage further by adding one extra ingredient. Literally, the most important thing that the beach provides is seafood. And the most important thing that seafood provides is essential fatty acids, which are a crucial ingredient in brains. In fact, nearly two-thirds of the human brain is made from them. Fatty acids are good for making membranes, and brains use electrical signals in membranes to compute. Myelin, in a membrane sheath surrounding nerve cells, speeds up the transmission of signals in the human nervous system by a factor of 5 or so. It takes a lot of essential fatty acids, then, to make a big, fast human brain. So it must have taken almost as much to make the brain of our distant ape ancestor. Oddly, though, our bodies cannot make those special fatty acids from simpler chemicals, like we make most complicated biochemicals that we need. We have to get the fatty acids ready-made from our food. That's why the word essential is used to describe them. Even more oddly, there are few essential fatty acids out on the savannas. They would exist only in living creatures, of course, but even there, they are fairly rare. The richest source of essential fatty acids is seafood. Perhaps all this explains why we want to spend so much time on the beach. But whatever the explanation, the ability to make big brains was one key step in our evolution away from our hairy, quadrupedal, 100,000-fold great-grandfather. Big brains, however, are not enough. What really matters is what you do with them. And what we managed to do was to play off one brain against another, so that over the millennia they got better and better at competing and communicating. Ape brains competing with lion brains leads to an arms race that improves both. But the arms race is fairly slow, because both brains are being used for very limited purposes as far as the competition goes. Ape brains competing with other ape brains gives the whole brain a workout all the time, so the rate of evolution is likely to be much higher. For every species, the main competition comes from other creatures of the same species. This is reasonable. They're the ones that want exactly the same resources that you do. This opens the door to elvish interference in our Discworld metaphor. The nasty side of human nature, which in extremes leads to evil, is inescapably bound up with the nice side. One very direct way to compete with your neighbour is to bash him on the head, hard. However, there are more subtle ways to gain evolutionary advancement, as we will see later. The elvish approach is crude and ultimately self-defeating for a sufficiently intelligent species. The possession of brains opens up new non-genetic ways to pass characteristics onto your children. You can give them a good start in life by moulding how their brains react to the outside world. The generic term for this kind of non-genetic transfer between the generations is privilege. There are numerous instances of privilege in the animal kingdom. When a mother blackbird provides yolk in her egg for the baby blackbird to feed from, that's privilege. When a cow provides milk for her calf, that's even more privilege. When a mother tarantula wasp provides a paralyzed living spider for her grubs to grow in, that's privilege. Humans have taken privilege to a qualitatively new level. Human parents invest an astonishing amount of time and effort in their children, and spend decades, entire lifetimes in many ways, looking after them. In conjunction with big brains, slowly getting bigger as each generation passes, privilege leads to two new tricks, learning and teaching. Those tricks feed off each other, and both require the best brain you can acquire. It helps considerably to steal privilege from other species, for instance, all that food material in plant seeds, tubers, and bulbs. Genes are involved in building brains, and genes can, perhaps, predispose individuals to be unusually good at learning or teaching. However, both of these educational processes involve far more than mere genes. They take place within a culture. The child does not just learn from its parents. It learns from its grandparents, from its siblings, from its aunts and uncles, and from the whole troop or tribe. It learns, as all parents discover to their dismay, from undesirable sources as well as authorized ones. Teaching is the attempt to transmit ideas from the adult brain to that of the child. Learning is the child's attempt to insert those ideas into its brain. The system is imperfect, with a lot of garbled messages along the way, but despite its faults, it is much faster than genetic evolution. That's because brains, networks of nerve cells, can adapt much more rapidly than genes can. The faults, oddly enough, probably accelerate the process, because they are a source of creativity and innovation. An accidental misunderstanding may sometimes lead to an improvement. It happens all the time on Discworld. In this respect, cultural evolution is just like genetic evolution. It is only because the DNA copying system makes mistakes that organisms can change. Culture didn't arise in a vacuum. It had many precursors. One crucial step towards the development of culture was the invention of the nest. Before nests came into being, any experimentation by the young either worked or led to a quick death. Within the protection of the nest, however, young animals can try things out, make mistakes, and profit from them. For example, by learning not to do the same thing again. Outside the nest, they never get a chance to try a second time. In this manner, nests led to another development, the role of play in educating the young animal. Mother cats bring half-dead mice for their kittens to practice hunting on. Mother birds of prey do the same for their offspring. Polar bear cubs slide down snow slopes and look cute. Play is good fun, and the kids enjoy it. At the same time, it equips them for their adult roles. Social animals, ones that gather in groups and operate as groups, are a fertile breeding ground for privilege and for education. And with appropriate communication, groups of animals can achieve things that no individual can manage. A good example is dogs, which evolve the ability to hunt in packs. When such tricks are being played, it is important to have some recognition signal that lets the pack distinguish its own members from outsiders. Otherwise, the pack can do all the work, and then an outsider can steal the food. Each dog pack has its own call sign, a special howl that only insiders know. The more elaborate your brain, the more elaborate the communication from brain to brain can be, and the more effectively education works. Communication helps with the organization of group behavior, and it opens up survival techniques that are more subtle than bashing others on the head. Within the group, cooperation becomes a far more viable option. Today's great apes generally work as small groups, and it seems likely that their ancestors did the same. When humans split off from the chimpanzee lineage, those groups became what we now call tribes. Competition between tribes was intense, and even today some jungle tribes in South America and New Guinea think nothing of killing anyone they meet who comes from a different tribe. This is a reversion to the bash on the head option, but now one group cooperates to bash the other group's members on the head, or usually one such member at a time. Less than a century ago, most such tribes did the same. One of the stories we've told ourselves throughout our tribal history is that we are the people, the true human beings, which means that everyone else isn't. Chimpanzees have been observed killing other chimpanzees, and they regularly hunt smaller monkeys for meat. That isn't cannibalism. The food is a different species. Most humans cheerfully consume other mammals, even quite intelligent ones like pigs. But we eat sheep too. Just as dog packs need an agreed recognition signal to identify their members, so each tribe needs to establish a distinct identity. The possession of big brains makes it possible to do this by means of elaborate, shared rituals. Ritual is by no means confined to humans. Many species of birds, for instance, have special mating dances, or engage in strange devices to attract the female's attention, like the decorative collection of berries and pebbles assembled by the male bowerbird. But humans, with their highly developed brains, have turned ritual into a way of life. Every tribe, and nowadays every culture, has developed a make-a-human kit whose object is to bring up the next generation to adopt the tribal or cultural norms and pass them on to their own children. It doesn't always work, especially nowadays, when the world has shrunk and cultures clash across non-geographical boundaries. Iranian teenagers accessing the internet, for example, but it still works surprisingly well. Corporations have taken up the same idea, with corporate bonding sessions. This is what the wizards were up to with their paintballs. Studies have shown that sessions of this kind have no useful effect, but businesses still waste billions on them every year. The second most probable reason is that such sessions are fun anyway. The first most probable is that everyone likes an opportunity to shoot Mr. Davis in human resources. And one important reason is that it sounds as though it ought to work. Our culture is full of stories where such things do. An important part of the Make a Human kit is the story. We tell our children stories, and through those stories, they learn what it is like to be a member of our tribe or our culture. They learn from the story of Winnie the Pooh getting stuck in Rabbit's Hole that greed can lead to constraints on food. From the Three Little Pigs, a civilizing story, not a tribal one, they learn that if you watch your enemy for repetitive patterns, you can outwit him. We use stories to build our brains, and then we use the brains to tell ourselves and each other stories. As time passes, those tribal stories acquire their own status. The people cease to question them because they are traditional tribal stories. They acquire a veneer of, well, the elves would call it glamour. They seem wonderful, despite numerous obvious faults, and most people do not question them. On Discworld, precisely this process occurred with stories and folk memories about elves, as we can illustrate with three quotations from Lords and Ladies. In the first, the god of all small furry prey, Herne the Hunted, has just come to the terrified realization that they're all coming back. Jason Ogg, who is a blacksmith, the eldest son of the witch Nanny Ogg, and not very bright, asks her who they are.
"The Lords and Ladies," she said. "Who are they?"
Nanny looked around. But after all, this was a forge. It wasn't just a place of iron. It was a place where iron died and was reborn. If you couldn't speak the words here, you couldn't speak them anywhere. Even so, she'd rather not.
"You know," she said, "the fair folk, the gentry, the shining ones, the star people, you know."
"What?"
Nanny put her hand on the anvil, just in case, and said the word. Jason's frown very gently cleared, at about the same speed as a sunrise.
"Them?" he said. "But aren't they nice and..."
"See," said Nanny, "I told you you'd get it wrong."
"You said, the shining ones. You said, the fair folk. And you spat and touched iron. But generations later, you forgot about the spitting and the iron, and you forgot why you use those names for them, and you remembered only that they were beautiful. We're stupid, and the memory plays tricks, and we remember the elves for their beauty and the way they move, and we forget what they were. We're like mice saying, 'Say what you like, cats have got real style.' Elves are wonderful. They provoke wonder. Elves are marvellous. They cause marvels. Elves are fantastic. They create fantasies. Elves are glamorous. They project glamour. Elves are enchanting. They weave enchantment. Elves are terrific. They beget terror. The thing about words is that meanings can twist just like a snake. And if you want to find snakes, look for them behind words that have changed their meaning. No one ever said elves are nice. Elves are bad." For most purposes, though admittedly not when dealing with elves, it doesn't greatly matter if the traditional tales make no real sense. Father Christmas and the Tooth Fairy make no immediate sense on Round World, but see Hogfather for their Discworld significance. Mind you, it's clear why children are happy to believe in such generosity. The most important role of the tribal Make a Human kit is to provide the tribe with its own collective identity, making it possible for it to act as a unit. Tradition is good for such purposes. Sense is optional. All religions are strong on tradition, but many are weak on sense, at least if you take their stories literally. Nevertheless, Religion is absolutely central to most cultures, make a human kit. The growth of human civilization is a story of the assembly of ever larger units, knitted together by some version of that make a human kit. At first, children were taught what they must do to be accepted as members of the family group. Then they were taught what they must do to be accepted as members of the tribe. Believing apparently ridiculous things was a very effective test. The naive outsider would all too readily betray a lack of belief, or would simply have no idea what the appropriate belief was. Is it permitted to pluck a chicken before dark on Wednesday? The tribe knew. The outsider did not. And since any reasonable person would guess yes, the tribal priesthood could go a long way by making the accepted answer no. After that, the same kind of thing happened for the local baron serfs, for the village, the town, the city, and the nation. We spread the net of true human beings. Once units of any size have acquired their own identity, they can function as units, and in particular, they can combine forces to make a bigger unit. The resulting structure is hierarchical. The chains of command reflect the breakdown into subunits and sub-subunits. Individual people, or individual subunits, can be expelled from the hierarchy or otherwise punished if they stray outside accepted or enforced cultural norms. This is a very effective way for a small group of people, barbarian, to maintain control over a much larger group, tribal. It works, and because of that, we still labour under its restrictions, many of which are undesirable. We have invented techniques like democracy to try to mitigate the undesirable effects, but these techniques bring new problems. A dictatorship can generally take action more rapidly than a democracy, for example. It's harder to argue. The path from ape to human is not just one of evolutionary pressures producing more and more effective brains, not just a tale of the evolution of intelligence. Without intelligence, we could never have got started on that path. But intelligence alone was not enough. We had to find a way to share our intelligence with others and to store useful ideas and tricks for the benefit of the whole group, or at least those in a position to make use of it. That's where extelligence comes into play. Extelligence is what really gave those apes the springboard that would launch them into sentience, civilization, technology, and all the other things that make humans unique on this planet. Extelligence amplifies the individual's ability to do good, or evil. It even creates new forms of good and evil, such as, respectively, cooperation and war. Extelligence operates by putting ever more sophisticated stories into the make-a-human-being kit. It pulled us up by our own bootstraps. We could climb from tribal to barbarian to civilized. Shakespeare shows us doing it. His period was not a rebirth of Hellenistic Greece or Imperial Rome. Instead, it was the culmination of the barbarian ideas of conquest, honor, and aristocracy, codified in the principles of chivalry, meeting its match in the written principles of a tribal peasantry, and disseminated by printing. This kind of sociological confrontation produced many events in which the two cultures meet head-on. This was exemplified by the Warwickshire enclosure uprisings. In Warwickshire, the aristocracy carved up land into small parcels, and the peasantry got very upset because the aristocracy didn't give any heed to what kind of land was in each parcel. All the aristocrats knew about peasant farming was a simplistic calculation. This much land will suffice for that many peasants. The peasants knew what was actually involved in growing food, so that the only thing you could do with a small piece of woodland, for instance, was to chop down all the trees to make room to grow some food. Today's bean-counting managerial style in many businesses and all British public services is exactly the same. This kind of confrontation between the barbarian attitudes of the nobility and the tribal ones of the peasantry is precisely portrayed in many of Shakespeare's plays. As an illustration of low life, with its folk wisdom as comic relief and pathos, set against the lofty ideals of the ruling classes, leading so often to tragedy, but also to high comedy, Think of Theseus, Duke of Athens, on the one hand, and Bottom on the other, in A Midsummer Night's Dream.